Hi, I'm Shanna Bennett, and you're listening to Matter of Life and Debt. Today, I'm here with Abigail Acheson, an organizer with Rethinking Economics USA. Rethinking Economics USA is a network of students and academics and professional allies who are working to change the teaching and practice of economics. I'm also here with my dear, dear producer and co-host, Talia Millay. Let's get into it. Welcome to the podcast. Hey, everybody. Hey.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Talia, take it away. I'm going to let you introduce Abigail so we can start chatting.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to have Abigail here. We met through an activist event through the Debt Collective. And what I love about this conversation that we're going to have now is that the Debt Collective and other grassroots movements fight for the cancellation of debt. And there's another piece, right? We need to rethink what higher education means and we need to make it free. And Abigail has been sitting with that question inside the academy. So Abigail, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are?
Sure. So I am a recent graduate. I graduated a year and a half ago, but I have since graduation been working with Rethinking Economics and been in contact with a lot of undergraduate and graduate students who are really motivated to rethink what they're learning in the classroom in economics, as well as other disciplines that have been deeply shaped by the dominant strain of economics that is taught. I studied history and education in school, and I interacted with economics in two different directions. In my history courses, I studied a lot about the economic realities of different places at different points in time and the forces that change those or cause those not to change. I also got to see in real time how a lot of these ideas that are promoted by neoclassical economics led into my education degree, in the sense that neoclassical economics is very focused on the individual, it's very focused on maximization of profit and efficiency. And those things really played out in the way that K-12 teaching shapes people to be individually competitive and work to self-manage themselves and build themselves up into this product that can then be very appealing to people hiring them. So those are things that were floating through my brain as I was in school and led me to Rethinking Economics, just because I was getting a glimpse through my studies into just how impactful economics curriculum is for a wide variety of areas in the university.
It's always really interesting to me when we go through the process of getting a higher education and we're supposed to be taught throughout that process this out-of-the-box critical thinking. But I love when it kind of spins on its head and we actually start looking at the institutions that are teaching us. And essentially, from reviewing some of the things that Talia sent me in advance of our conversation, it seems like one of the main ideas here is that the overall economics education that you received and other folks are receiving is lacking, and it's lacking in perspective, right? And depth. Is that the case?
Yeah. So for us, members of Rethinking Economics are really motivated to rethink the teaching and practice of economics because that is a really critical juncture point for changing our economic system, bettering our economic system to be one that prioritizes the well-being of people and prioritizes the well-being of planet. People who are trained in economics, who take economics courses, they often go into positions of incredible influence, whether that be on a board in a bank or in an investment firm or working in the IMF with the World Bank or going into government and having decision-making power over policies at whatever level that may be. So what's taught in economics is actually really, really crucial to changing our larger economic system and how we do or do not provide for the well-being of people.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And to continue off of that, I'm wondering how, as a younger generation is coming out of academia, specifically out of an economics field, if you can go back to when you were in school, learning what you were learning and then being faced with the outside world where all of this catastrophe is really happening right now, where the future for our younger generation seems dire, not just climate-wise, but also economically or financially. What are some of the things that play out for you all when you're, well, when you were in that position?
Yeah, I am really glad you asked this question, because I was in school, I was definitely really concerned with the ongoing climate crisis, with diminishing prospects and increasing precarity for graduates. And throughout all of the years that I was at university, I was keenly aware of the debt I was having to take on to be in school, how that was something that I would have to shoulder for years after graduation, and what that meant for what kind of a job I would have to pursue or what kind of a career path I couldn't pursue because of that. I have about $11,000 in student debt, federal student debt, but if it weren't for the assistance of family members and assistance of family work benefits, I would have had upwards of $55,000 in student debt.
Wow.
Upon graduation. So I'm incredibly privileged in that sense, where I'm benefiting from unequal and discriminatory practices as a white American, in that I'm able to make use of the wealth that my family has been able to accrue in order to fund an education with not no debt, but much less debt than I would have otherwise been able to. So those were things that were constantly on my mind in school. We recently conducted a survey of students, the RUSA network did. We surveyed over 2,000 undergraduate students, and the results of that survey are strikingly on par with many of the experiences that I had in my undergraduate education, in that students consistently reported feeling that our generation is worse off than our parents' or grandparents' generation in terms of financial prospects and ability to achieve a stable financial situation. Students were asked to describe the U.S. economy, and the words most used were unfair, unequal, corrupt, outdated, unjust. About 95% of all students reported that they believe that current economic system in the U.S. should be amended or drastically changed, which is a really striking number. About 95% of undergraduate students in this sample felt that things were to the point of needing change, deep change, in order to provide for themselves in the future. So students are definitely concerned about what all this means for our ability to provide for ourselves and live a fulfilling, healthy life in future. Students are also aware of how this relates to larger problems. For instance, the top four concerns for all undergrads in the survey were racism and racial discrimination, inflation, climate change, and economic inequality. Students are wanting to learn about these things and wanting to make use of an education which is an incredible commitment of time, an incredible commitment of energy, an incredible commitment of resources, both financial and otherwise. They want to make use of their courses to understand the most pressing issues that we're facing today. The majority of students, upwards of 60%, reported that they rely on their courses and their curriculum to make sense of issues affecting the U.S. economy. This is why economics curriculum taught in classrooms at universities is so incredibly important, because these are the halls that purport to explain to students how the world works and help them orient themselves to where they fit into the world, how things operate, how does this fit into a larger trajectory of history, really like getting one's bearings and being trained in how to think about the world and how to approach problems. So to have the vast majority of students in this survey report that they did not study ecological economics, this was for the economic students sample of the survey. We surveyed all undergrads, and then we surveyed a portion of just economic students to get a sense of what they were learning in their courses. And a majority did not study ecological economics, did not study feminist economics, did not study stratification theory, and were not familiar with these different schools, which would have helped them to really gain a deeper understanding of these crises, of these realities that are deeply shaping our present and our future.
You're bringing up a good point. Students of economics are studying this thread of society that affects all of us. At one point in your discussion earlier, you mentioned that you're just being prepared as a product, right? And the fact that you're understanding that you're being prepared as a product for the system, and you're also seeing how precarious your life is going to be after you graduate, the amount of debt that you might accrue after graduation. Understanding this at that deeper level of finance and economics, how did that really simply make you feel? And I'm wondering that because I feel that I probably would have quit. Halfway, I would have been like, this is bullshit. I'm out. So I'm wondering, what made you stay? What was that aha moment for you where you realized, wow, economics is failing U.S. colleges?
Yeah, I appreciate this question because there were so many moments where I wanted to leave school and just run away screaming and never return. Because it's an incredibly difficult thing to be in that environment and having to just grind your way through it. So I would say I definitely felt demoralized and frustrated, overwhelmed, but most of all, probably alone and isolated, because university can be an incredibly isolating experience. And I think what allowed me to keep going was the professors that I had, the peers that I had, other students, recent graduates who I spoke with who had gotten to the other side, were able to express similar frustrations about this. That community really was what made the difference, because none of us can do anything probably very worthwhile all on our own. We always need other people. We always need to learn from other people, work with other people. And so that's what got me through. I think what made me see most clearly that the economic system wasn't working was really leaning into study about inequality and unequal access to power and history. That really made a big difference. And I think also just a testimony to the importance of social sciences and humanities, the education of any person, having a place where students are asking really tough why questions that don't necessarily have a mathematical formula to answer with. And of course, math is an incredible thing. You can do so many incredible things with all these really complex models and mathematical modes of thinking. But it's true of anything that that can't be the only thing that we do. And so there's a really great article in the New Republic that was recently published that talks about the rise of economism and how for the past 40, 50 years, the tenets of neoclassical economics have really dominated governance and policymaking in a way that has too easily moved into avoiding questions of moral commitment. And questions of moral priority by rendering very technical the process of governance, the process of resource distribution, when in fact, at base, those are moral questions. That's something that so many of our members talk about repeatedly, the aversion to things in their courses. I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to who are current economic students who talk about just kind of disgust is maybe a strong word, but just kind of the resistance that they encounter when they are asking critical questions about what they're learning in economics. And what makes that so potentially dangerous is that what the vast majority of economics departments are teaching almost exclusively is neoclassical economics and Austrian economics. But the way it's taught is as if that is economics, as opposed to those are two schools of thought in economics. Okay. And so if students are not able to question that or even broach the statement that these are two schools of many of economic thought, and then these students are the ones going up to boards and banks and policymaking rooms, how will that enable us to move past this kind of reign of economism that has dominated our systems of governance for the past 40 or 50 years?
Yeah, the trickle-down economics.
That's fascinating. So the goal is to organize around changing the approach to economics in higher education and socially, right?
Yeah, so our assessment comes from a look into the history of universities in the US. And we actually have a really rich history of student organizing and student campaigning around curriculum reform. In the 60s and 70s, there was immense mobilization among students to change their curriculum in really fundamental ways. We saw the rise of demands for ethnic studies programs, particularly in California. In the 90s, there was similar organizing around those demands. And for anyone interested in this, there's a really excellent book that I would recommend called We Demand, the University and Student Protests. It's by the wonderful Roderick Ferguson. And in that book, he charts the campaigning around really actually fundamental questions of who the university is for, who the university should produce knowledge for, and for what purpose. And as students of color, as queer students, as low-income students were organizing to demand curriculum that helped them live fulfilling and healthy lives and helped their communities fight forces that were producing inequality and pushing them down. There was actually a really robust alignment of government and some businesses to stall that effort. And so I see that as evidence of just how potentially powerful that could have been. The way the university is now in so many ways has been deeply impacted, and that's a direct result of student organizing that took place around curriculum reform specifically. So for RUSA, the evidence points to students are at a point of incredible frustration and disappointment oftentimes with what they're learning in their courses. And the only way that curriculum will really change in some of the profound ways that we'd like to see is if students are the ones to demand that. There's a really great recent example of this over at University of Barcelona. There were students there who were protesting in hopes of getting the university to divest from fossil fuels, as well as implement a mandatory course for all students to study the climate crisis and understand climate change. And they were able to get that course approved by the university. Starting 2024, all students at the University of Barcelona will be taking that mandated course on climate change.
Fantastic.
And that's a really exciting development because it shows really clearly that when students mobilize en masse, when students are collectively talking to one another and making clear asks of what they'd like to see changed in their, it can be done. And in fact, in many ways, it's not a particularly unreasonable request to have all students take a course on climate change. There's no particularly large costs for the university in that sense. And it's pretty widely accepted that we are in a climate crisis and that that is escalating every year. But it wasn't implemented before. It could have been implemented before, but it took students mobilizing en masse to make that happen. So there's so many examples of student organizing producing curriculum change at university. And that's, for us, the best way to ensure that the kind of curriculum change we want to see in economics classrooms and economics program, because we want economics programs to also value and encourage students to take courses in other disciplines. Many programs For instance, my history program requires that I take courses in at least two or three other subjects. Most economics programs do not have that requirement. And so these are just some of the things that we'd like to see changed in economic programs and economic classrooms, and that the survey results really show are a need and are lacking, despite students' desire to study climate change, despite students' desire to study racism and racial inequality. Over 57% of respondents said that they wanted to study their subject because they wanted to understand the world better. And so if their courses are not addressing the most pressing issues of the world, how can they be said to be answering that need, to be serving the customer of the student?
That's a really good point that you make. As borrowers and as students, we are the customers. And there was a moment, I think it was not this past summer, maybe it was last summer, I forget. There's an HBCU where the students walked out of class and basically started protesting. And it went on for days and days and days. And one of the most disturbing things I took away from that was, I don't think the university was acknowledging that those kids are paying upwards of $50K a year. $50K a year as the customers of this university. And they had them out there striking for like days and days, rain and cold, before the president finally acknowledged them and actually engaged in a conversation. And all these kids were asking for was a conversation so that they could air out some of their grievances. And they were legitimate. I mean, it wasn't anything wild. It wasn't like a bouncy house in the quad or something. They were legitimate. And it was just really unfortunate. I think sometimes that piece of that relationship is lost when we talk about universities versus students. Like, we are ultimately the customers and we're paying customers. That's a very good point that you made.
Yeah. I just wanted to add that our network is wanting to rethink the teaching and practice of economics, but we're also committed to embodying that rethinking of the content of economics programs, in the sense that we want to reimagine the economics and finances of universities. Universities increasingly are taking on a lot of debt to finance day-to-day education, and yet to what extent, for what purpose, from whom they're borrowing, all of these questions, and on what conditions, all of these questions are rarely disclosed to the people who make that university work, whether that be the custodians, the adjunct faculty, the staff, the students. The wide variety of people that make the university work day to day are not party to the decisions that a university makes. It's also true, over the past couple of years, we've seen a rise in student unionization drives, student workers unionizing, particularly grad students, but in some cases, undergraduate students like at Kenyon College, who are demanding a reevaluation of their role and their purpose in the university. So we've talked about students as products, we've talked about students as customers, but students are also workers.
That's a good point.
Yeah. To bounce off of this, one of the things that the Debt Collective resists really is paying for schools. That's why one of the movement's goal is to achieve free college for all, free university for all. And I feel that one of the things that gets in the way of imagining university and college free is this idea of the student being the customer, of the student being the client. And it shouldn't be that relationship. Academia, or spaces that hold at its center the co-production of knowledge, should not be paid for. We are putting our minds together to bring about culture. And so it is super important for us to be able to have these spaces, and they need to be accessible for everyone. People should not have to be at the border but just losing it all in order to participate in something so important as the upholding, the shifting of culture. Because we go to school to learn, but we also go to school to weave ourselves into each other. And clearly academia, not just economics, needs to be decolonized. And so my next question would be, because it's hard to do this in academia, and I understand this, what are some of the spaces that you and Rethinking Economics cultivate or create to imagine a new space or a decolonized space for the co-production of knowledge?
So for us, most members are involved in learning with their peers what they feel is missing in their economics course. And so that often produces spaces where students are diversifying and decolonizing and democratizing what they're learning in courses with one another. That collaboration, that kind of contingent negotiation of what we want to together learn and know is very much in that realm that you're talking about. I will say that it's also true that I think there's definitely more work to be done about encouraging students to think really about what they're learning in economic classrooms, what the recommendations of academia have achieved in the past. So to that end, we are in the course of developing a few different events that are responding to the UC worker strike that just recently occurred and what that maybe means for rethinking the university and rethinking the financial functioning of universities. We also are talking to a few other national networks, especially the ARI UNAM in Mexico National Network, about doing a piece on what is the history of economic imperialism and how has that played out. So for any listeners who are interested in that, I would definitely recommend keeping an eye on our Twitter page and elsewhere to keep appraised of those. But yeah, I would say those are the spaces. Students themselves, the members, they really create those spaces in the reading groups and learning groups that they build response to these lacking elements in their courses. And I should also say, there are many professors who are incorporating degrowth theory, who are incorporating qualitative methods, who are incorporating other aspects of economics that are incredibly useful and important. What the students I've talked to have identified, though, is that this is not the majority of what students are being exposed to. It's a kind of often haphazard case that they might be exposed to this. Maybe they can't get the one professor who does this in the economics department of 25 professors. So we are really thinking together about what would it mean for economics curriculum to be diversified, decolonized, and democratized across the board. And what would that mean for the kind of people that it produces and the way it trains people to engage in a democratic society after graduation?
When you reached out to me, you wrote this wonderful line where you said, "Debt as a tool of profit is lionized in university classrooms." Can you talk a little bit more about that for us?
So the context that comes to mind at the moment for this is often in development courses, international relations courses and economics courses that are interacting with development in some sense. Debt and financialization are often treated as tools to solve what are often political problems. So, for example, microloans are often treated as a way to address dispossession of people who've just lost their land, people who are systemically barred from getting much less onerous or exploitative loans from nearby credit unions or collective banks. So this is kind of the way in which debt is lionized in economics classrooms. I will say also that debt in the most popularly used economics textbooks very rarely talk about the debt of an individual person. They often talk about government debt. And in many ways, that's an oversight because at this point in history, individual debt plays such an important role in enabling people to live their lives and they buy basic things. One example that comes to mind is we have seen more and more those apps which offer to you your paycheck before you receive your paycheck, which is essentially a very short-term loan because so many people are making use of these debts, there's clearly a failure to provide for people's needs on a mass scale, but the individual effects of that are not touched on in most economics textbooks. For instance, the kind of most commonly used textbook, Greg Mankiw's Principles of Economics, barely touches on individual debt. 75% of mentions of debt pertain to government debt alone. And when it does address individual debt, it's often kind of lacking analysis that states that debt affects creditors and debtors differently, but doesn't go into anything that would make clear where the societal lack of providing for people comes in.
And understanding economics and the system the way that you do, you have incorporated other disciplines in order to understand power dynamics and understand oppression and the many ways it affects us. How do you envision a future where debt is not the main means of living? I think a lot of us just understand even the way that we talk about our credit scores, which is essentially debt. The more debt you have, the higher your credit score, right? So we, or society, seems to just accept it. Like, I got to get a credit card so I can get debt. That way I can buy a house or do this or do that. We're so conditioned to just agree with debt and that it's a normal part of life and that's just the way it should be. So with your understanding and across discipline understanding, how do you all envision a society where debt is not at the forefront? That's a lot to think through, but I'm curious.
Yeah, no, it is a very big question. And I can probably talk about a few smaller aspects of that. So trend over the past 40, 50 years has been increasing financialization of just everything. And in many instances, the best way to make money is to invest in something, isn't to necessarily produce a product or buy materials to make a certain thing or provide a certain service, but it's actually the buying and selling and speculating, which is speculating on financial assets. And that's all well and good, except that this often overlooks how it's affecting people on the ground who aren't in the investment world. So I think addressing that kind of spiraling out of control trend would be a good first step. And part of that requires that students are learning about the history of economic thought, economic trends, and are able to identify when different schools of thought are in play, because that's how we can change governance and the policymaking that takes place, which allows or disallows rampant speculation on land, on debt itself, on housing, as we saw in the 08 financial crisis. That really is one way that I envision kind of addressing the widespread prevalence of debt. I think also we probably need to recognize once again the value of the commons and common goods and enabling the sharing of resources as something that isn't shameful, but it is incredibly beneficial and community building and providing for the well-being of people. That will require, you know, a lot of on-the-ground work in a lot of different ways, but I think having students be familiar with economic arguments, particularly kind of the dominant mainstream economic arguments that we see so prevalent in arguments for or against policies, I think that will help enable us to recognize once again, like, value of the commons and public goods, which will enable people to meet their needs without relying on debt. That's what I would say. It's a really, really important question, I think, especially because of how central debt is to life in the United States, not just in the United States, but especially here where we have student debt, housing debt, auto debt is on the rise, you know, medical debt is a huge problem, just personal living expense debt that people need to rely on kind of perpetual credit card debt often to pay for their basic needs. Those are all evidence of just how central debt is to life here in the States. And yeah, I would really encourage people who are in school now and were thinking as much as I was about my student debt and asking that very question of what would it look like to no longer have a society that relies so heavily on debt to maintain people's lives.
Do you have some sense of why the teaching on economics seems to be, let's call it, limited or maybe one-sided? Is there some kind of reasoning why it seems limited, do you think?
Yeah, the why is a great question, because my understanding is that it's really gotten increasingly limited in the past 40 years. And I don't think that it is a coincidence that is a period directly following really robust organizing on a variety of fronts in the 60s and 70s. There was a really influential memorandum, that it's called the Powell Memorandum, that discusses university student organizing as a threat to the health of the American economy and suggests that market ideals are the best way to ensure that American society doesn't falter, doesn't become something incredibly hostile to business and financiers and the accrual of wealth generally, I would say. That was a really influential written by Lewis Powell, who went on to be a Supreme Court justice, and I believe was involved in the case which concluded that corporations are people and money is speech, which of course has incredibly broad repercussions for society at all levels in this country. So I would say that was definitely an influencer of the consolidation of economics classrooms into only focusing on these one or two schools of thought.
Interesting.
It benefits the system itself. And we know now academia to just be, as you mentioned earlier, Abigail, it produces the worker and it indoctrinates also the worker. So yeah, I can see why, especially in economics, you're only going to be talking about that which perpetuates the system and its progress.
And I think something we haven't mentioned yet is that the rise of student debt and the defunding of universities or removing access to public funds for universities in practice makes it so that students' priority becomes getting a job and ensuring that a person has a stable job after graduation. And things have occurred in such a way that economics is seen to be the most practical of majors. The majority of people who study economics say that they chose the discipline to understand the world, but a sizable minority also say that they chose it in order to have good job prospects after graduation. Actually, Reagan recommended defunding public universities in California at the height of student organizing there, kind of saying, well, if they have to pay their way through, then they won't have all this leisure time to organize around their classes. So the increase of student debt that has been ballooning in universities, that's had a really productive function in making it so that students are more reluctant or unable or feel they're unable to question what they're learning in their classrooms. They are unable to expand their curriculum, demand more schools of thought be taught, demand more thinkers be taught, and generally aim to diversify, decolonize, and democratize their economics. We've talked about decolonizing, but it's also true that diversifying and democratizing economics curriculum is equally important. And diversifying the curriculum isn't just because students of color have their feelings hurt when particular thinkers are left out of the curriculum. It's actually to make the curriculum more rigorous, more fully capable of explaining the world and explaining how the world works. Oftentimes, some of the arguments given for leaving the curriculum as it is, which is to say, largely teaching the ideas and recommendations of white male scholars, is that there isn't enough time to add another person to the curriculum. It's already so tight. We have a very tight semester. There isn't time to add another person. But in fact, if you want to study gender and you put Angela Davis in the, you will have understood race and gender. Mm-hmm. If you want to study capitalism and how that functions, if you want to understand the bases of economic exchange, and you study W.E.B. Du Bois, you're going to understand capitalism and race. So arguments that there isn't enough time or room in the curriculum to diversify the ideas are kind of ingenuous and perhaps aren't really taking the project seriously as one that would increase the rigor and the value and the depth of learning that students receive. And so it's kind of a joint convergence in economics classrooms in particular, in that the recommendations of neoclassical economics say, well, privatization is the best route for the betterment of society. And that same privatization has put pressures on students such that they are reluctant, unable, and struggle to do much more than get their degree and get a good job afterwards.
There's also the military component of that we were talking about recently, and it comes up periodically when we talk about student debt and military recruitment. I think that that's also a motivator to keep the status quo as it is.
Yeah, for sure.
What are your thoughts on Biden's plan for student debt relief as it stands now? The 10 or 20K, the overall structure of it?
Yeah. It's a great first step, but I would say I was disappointed a little bit when the plan came out, because it is pretty partial relief for the vast majority of people. It would have taken just a small amount of different circumstances for me to have 45, 50 grand more than what Biden is agreeing to cancel. So yeah, it is a little perhaps underwhelming, but every little bit counts. And so that's definitely exciting that 10 grand of relief will go out to folks. I think, I'm trying to think here also, because there's definitely a connecting piece between the argument that if we want students to be productive members of society after graduation, student debt really inhibits that in a lot of ways. And so I think perhaps that's kind of an argument going forward to encourage more forgiveness in the future. But yeah, I would say overall, I'm happy to have that relief, but we definitely need to keep fighting for more.
Well, Abigail, I didn't think that economics could be so interesting, to tell you the truth. So thank you so much for sitting here and explaining to us all this fascinating knowledge. Before we close, I'm wondering if we could do this little exercise. If you were to wake up one day and the world were fine and not the mess that we have it as, what would it look like economically?
I would really like to see more solidarity economy work being done. There's a really great organization in Boston called the Center for Economic Democracy, and they've done a lot of work around participatory budgeting. And that has been really exciting for me to follow and learn more about. So I think just generally having more collective means of making economic decisions, a big aspect of what we're implicitly told about economics is that it's something very complex. It's something very technical that the vast majority of us can't understand and probably shouldn't even try to understand, and that it's the experts who know best in terms of what to do in economics. And Ha-Jun Chang has a wonderful video where he says that 95%, I'm probably misquoting, but 95% of economics is just common sense, and the rest is a little bit of math. So it's definitely the case that we're able to participate in economic decisions, and that's imperative if we want to live in a true democracy. So I would want to see more collective economic decision-making, more transparency about economics in the example I mentioned earlier about university debt. It would be possible for universities to make their budgets much more visible and their budget decisions much more visible to members of the university at all levels. And that might be a great first step towards more participatory economic decision-making in universities.
Abigail, do you have anything that you want to touch on that we haven't touched on?
I did kind of have a short and I wanted to include about the real possibility for like really profound, widespread change that can come out of university organizing. Mm-hmm. In particular, like students involved in the University of California system organizing in the 60s and 70s, many of those students went on to found the Black Panther Party and participate really actively in the Black Panther Party, which of course has had an deep impact on national politics as well as local politics in a variety of contexts. And just in the fact that we wouldn't have school breakfast programs without the Black Panther Party. That was something that they initiated and operated as part of party policy. It was only later that the US government mandated schools provide. That's just an example of one way that student organizing is really something that can have such widespread effects across society. And I emphasize that also because there's often a dismissal of, we saw this in student unionizing efforts, of students who are looking to change something about the university or looking to campaign, seen as kind of a parochial effort, a little bit naive, not going to go very far, realistic. And once students graduate, they'll be out in the real world and they see that things aren't as nice as they'd like them to be. But in fact, I've seen over and over again how, just even in the example of the Powell memo, a huge impact that had on business policy and government policy, that students have really deep impacts on society. I wanted to say that bit. And then,
and where can we send people if they're interested in learning more?
So Rethinking Economics USA is a national network. It's part of the Rethinking Economics International, which is a network that was founded about 8 years ago in response to the 2008 financial crisis and the fact that students in the UK were really frustrated with the lack of addressal, lessons that could have been learned from that financial crisis in their economics courses. There were kind of continuing business as usual, and these students were saying, well, it seems like there was a failure of the discipline to adequately predict and address fallout of this financial crash. RUSA is a relatively newer network, but we do have a number of chapters around the U.S. We have groups at Georgetown, Middlebury, University of Vermont. We also have groups at Connecticut College and Stanford, as well as a budding group at American University and a few other groups in their very beginning stages across the Midwest. So we really have a wide reach and looking to reach more students and grow our network, because the more people that we can bring in, the more learning we can do, the more we can better understand our problems that we're encountering in economics education, and collectively decide what we might want to do about it.
That's awesome. Thank you for the work that you're doing. And I'm so glad that we got connected this way, because now we know of you. Now more people will know about you. So This is great. Do you guys have any upcoming events or anything you want to share or touch on?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we are going to host a couple different events in the months of January and February, one of which will touch on the recent UC California worker strikes out in University of California. And yeah, learning about what they've been doing, what conditions led them to their strike, and what maybe this means for how the economics of university might be reimagined. We're also planning an event with Ari Unam concerning the past economic policies of the U.S. government and how that has negatively impacted the Mexican economy. We are also in the midst of planning a very exciting project, which is developing a Economics 101 course, which is intended to provide students with a lot of the topics and subjects that they've reported are missing in their, you know, mainstream intro to macro, intro to micro courses. So this is really intended to be a true survey course of the discipline that will provide students an overview of the history of economic thought, exposure to a variety of schools of thought in economics, and contributions from other disciplines that have maybe, you know, influenced or changed economic thought throughout its history. So it's set to be a really exciting course. We have a number of partners joining us on the project. Listeners should definitely keep a lookout on our social media for more information on that. We're hoping to launch something over the summer. So if anyone's looking for a little extra something to do this summer, they should definitely join.
That's great. Can you tell us what your website is and what your Twitter handles and all that?
Yeah. So anyone interested in learning more about those events or generally getting to see kind of our regular educational content should go to our Twitter page. That's at @RethinkEcon_USA. They can also follow the Rethinking Economics International web Twitter page, which is at RethinkEcon. That's ECON. They're also welcome to check out the website. There's a lot of really resources there. You can see what all the different groups are up to. We have more than 120 different networks across the globe. So there's definitely a lot of activity for students interested to peruse through and learn from. Anyone interested in learning more about the survey can also go to our website, which is rethinkeconomics.org. There's a carousel right on that homepage that students will see more information about the survey we conducted in the US on. Students are also more than welcome to contact us directly. You can message us on Twitter. We're very responsive and active on there. So if you have any questions or thoughts that you'd want to share, feel free to reach out to us there. You can also email us at usa@rethinkeconomics.org. Feel free to contact us with questions, ideas. If you hear this and you're interested in getting involved but not sure where to get started, definitely shoot us an email there and we will get back to you very soon.
Anything in closing, Talia?
This has been really informative, super informative, and just getting the wheels of the brain going, the imagination going. I'm happy for the future, really. It's in the hands of a newer generation that's thinking the way that you are, Abigail, and so that makes me happy. Hopefully in my elder ages, I'm going to be living some of the things that you imagined.
Yeah, I hope so. And I would just kind of say to any listeners who are interested, but maybe not sure if this is for them or intimidated to kind of even think about changing the curriculum that your professor hands you, that could be a scary thing. But it's been done before and it becomes much less scary if you're learning about how to do that with other people. So if you're thinking about this or feel frustration with what you're learning in economics or in another social science, definitely reach out to us. I'm happy to answer any questions that people have. And yeah, really excited to see where things go in future.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come back again.
Thank you,
Abigail. Anytime.
Oh, for sure.
If you like this episode of Matter of Life and Debt, subscribe and share it with a friend. It really helps people discover us. Matter of Life and Debt is hosted by me, Shanna Bennett, and Talia Malay, and created by Nikki Nolan. It is produced by Emma Klauber, Nikki Nolan, Talia Malay, and Shanna Bennett. It is edited by Talia Malay and Nikki Nolan. Transcripts and social media writing is done by Emma Klauber. Our theme music was created by F.A. Achman. Visit our website, matteroflifeanddebt.com, where you can listen to more episodes, access transcripts, and get additional context for the subjects you just heard about. Absolutely for free. The website again, matteroflifeanddebt.com. Thanks again for listening.